I am 3 minutes early. Get everything done, so to wait for 3 minutes. Maybe by the end of the semester, I'll actually be like 10 minutes early. So, I practice my names. Christian. No, not Christian. Nicholas. Nick. Okay, I got Nick. There we am. Oh, I got that right. Okay. Starts with a W. William.
Almost.
Yeah.
Cowboy.
Huh? Take
it to Cowboy.
Why? Wyatt?
Yeah.
Wyatt.
What's your name?
Nick.
Oh,
Nick.
Yeah.
This
moves
there.
How do you spell
that? You go by Nick or Nicholas?
No, I go by Nick.
Well, maybe I have to have one Nick and one Nicholas.
Okay.
So I almost got the first four.
Yeah.
So, oh yeah, I gotta get the other ones.
Can I zoom in a little bit more?
So you can watch the airplanes flying. None of this 34,000, 36,000 feet. That happens. Weird altitudes. But maybe that's low, not low. When you guys do your single engine and stuff, what altitudes do you usually fly at? Like, is it
well,
standard?
You start off
like 7, 8.
And
then
yeah.
Start at 8,000?
For when you do multi-engine?
Okay, multi-engine, sure. Yeah.
Well,
when you're just flying, like if you could do a cross-country or something.
Oh, you just like 55, 65, 80.
Yeah.
And then 7 hours, it's like 65,
85. 6,500.
I guess 6,000.
So 6,500 is what you usually fly at? 8500. Yeah. I guess that's kind of,
yes.
Guess I should have known that. But
yes.
You guys got to teach me about this stuff. So.
Well, we got to stay below 12,500.
Huh? Got to stay, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
the other thing is, I know, when we flew the citation around here, we always, it's nice to stay below 14,000-15,000, so you don't have to talk at Minneapolis Center. So you can stay with the local controller. So, but if we went above 15, we have to go to Minneapolis Center and talk to them. Okay. Let's see here. Okay, I think I wasted a couple minutes. Just for everybody else, we can start, but I was showing you our airplanes here that have been flying for my NASA project. So I think someone said that you can get on the NASA tracker, the public tracker one, and actually watch them to fly around too. So if you're bored of my lecture, go and check out the NASA mission tool public tracker. You got it? Yeah. So you can watch them. And so this tail numbers, and I think you could get it on, yeah. So you can probably just put in the tail numbers too, at like 4 point. Or and track it too, right? Because they should fly out with their flight plans. But yeah, they're flying back and forth along this. Yeah. So they got them up there, 65,000, 66. They're literally a class act. They're not in the notice. I think you guys go 100,000. What's it? There's a couple different definitions of where space goes there.
Not space, but like control airspace. I found both of them.
You found both of them? Yeah. Yeah. So this is the EO2 right now.
Yep.
So, and they're making these loops. It's EO2 flies so much faster, right? Ground speed.
That's cool.
But see the ground speed of the P3, and they're trying to line them up. So P3 can't go any faster, and EO2 can't go any slower. So, this is the slowest speed for him. Fastest for. And then I can see, this is what I care about. This is liquid water clouds. Remember we've been talking about liquid water concentration. Actually, this is not the liquid water. Liquid water is on this one. But they're basically zero liquid water. This one has liquid water. They might have got rid of it there. But we're going to look at the pink one. This is a Rosemont Ison detector 12. These are the ison detector probes they have on a commercial aircraft with the little rods that vibrate. So it's a, and I don't know if usually it just gives a pilot a warning saying ison, and we look at the raw data. Okay, I think I got the screen shared, the audio, and I that mouse and see here. I got all the lectures up on the website, and I think you can click on all the audio ones. And I put on here, I finally uploaded the first couple ones from Izzy and Jonathan. So I got their stuff up there. But the big thing is you got the third assignment due today by the end of the day. Don't forget about that if you haven't handed that in. And we'll have a test next Thursday. So bring your laptops. We're doing it in a room here. I'll open up a Blackboard site with a lockdown browser. I talked to Fred Reamer. You all know Fred, right?
Right.
Yeah, so Fred's going to help me out get you guys all set for exam. So in this class, during the test, you can't look at my slides and notes, but they're always here. So when you get out of the class, you can. But you can use it for studying, but not for the exams. Okay, so the exam will be just your own knowledge to answer the questions. Okay, and I'll try not to have too many just easy things to Google for that. So, so at the end, I got a study guide that I posted on here. So we'll go over the study guide at the end, and we'll have the test next Thursday in class. I think I'll give you the entire class time, but we do have to leave by 3:20-ish because there's another class in here afterwards. But it should probably take most of you probably 45, 50 minutes. You make 30, 40 questions. Yes, both of them, about half and half. So a lot of multiple choice and a lot of short answer. I haven't written it. You guys all like the multiple choice? It's actually harder in a lot of ways sometimes. It's more easier to grade. You can ask me questions if the question doesn't make sense. Sometimes I have misspellings and don't always write the question the way it should supposed to be. So ask me questions. And if you've got to be gone, I know a couple people have to be. So let me know ahead before you take the test, or if something comes up on that day, send me an email. And then we'll just have to make it up on Monday or Friday.
How long is it going to be?
It'd be like 30 to 40 questions. It'd probably take you about 45 minutes. So I expect the average to take about 45 minutes. Maybe the first person be done in 30 minutes, and the last person will take the whole class period till 3:20. So you're welcome to stay here and agonize over that last answer and change it right at the last minute from the right answer to the wrong answer. Usually your first guess is right. So you can look at the study guide, ask me questions on Tuesday. The exam is going to be up to everything we covered today, but we'll have a lecture on Tuesday and that material will be on the exam. And probably the second exam will, I think I'll make all these comprehensive, but I'll focus more on the new material. But that way you have to review the old stuff. And if I get the materials and I'm really energetic, maybe we could do one on in a couple weeks. I don't know if we can do one right before spring break. Maybe we have to do it right after spring break. Let's see. Other questions about the exam? I'll go over the study guide at the end. And you can ask me questions there. So I guess the first thing I wanted to do, and there'll be some questions related to the homework assignments. So, but that'll be not too many, but there'll be like maybe 3 to 6 questions related to the homeworks. Somewhat, but they won't be the same ones as the homework, but it's the same topic type of things. And Izzy and Jonathan's lectures are open for questions too. So they talked about the North Dakota project and some of the equipment. They talked a lot about the equipment. So it's a little bit of a, but it's, I'm gonna try to keep things pretty basic. Okay, so I promised, let me see if I can make this bigger. Some information about the homework two and some, so let me make some comments and then you can ask questions. What's the main point of the article? And I think people got that. They kind of put that at the beginning. But the other one that a lot of people had problems with, is it an opinion piece or meant to provide facts? So it's a little bit tricky, but a lot of people missed it. There's like a big, on the article, it says opinion at the beginning of the article. And then it says at the end of the article, the opinions expressed here are not necessarily that of the edit of the article. So they use facts, but it's an opinion piece that really takes references from different places to try to reinforce their opinions that they want to make. So try to contrast that with the paper that we did this week. Okay, so that the first assignment was supposed to be like, this is an opinion, but it's written as it's not like devoid of reality. You know, it's not like science fiction or something that's meant to be totally non-factual. But it's not to provide its own original facts, for example. It references other people's papers. The idea of looking at these articles is to have this critical thinking skill. And that's how it's going to be on the test. It's really not, and you know, at the end of this, I say, you know, I'll skip to that later. The other thing you can do is you can look at how it references papers and stuff. The references are to bring in, like they said this to reinforce their opinions instead of the way we kind of reference it in sciences. These are about the instruments we're using, or sometimes we do reference papers, but a lot of times we reference papers that have different observations or have a different, just as much as people that agree with us in our observations. You know, how were their observations different? So you can look at how they reference them. The motivation behind it. I guess I was thinking a lot of the motivation is to, you know, you could say provide the opinions, but I looked at the motivations in terms of the funding. How do they make their money, and why does this all place publish this? Okay. So if you saw this, there's a bunch of ads that they put around it. So the publishers and even the person writing it, it's to sell these ads to get subscription. So that's how they're making their money. That's how the writers typically get paid. None of us can really typically afford to do a lot of stuff where we're not getting some income somehow, right? It's fun to fly an airplane, but someone has to pay for the gas that goes into it. So maybe if they're not paying the pirates, it's the same thing here. You got to pay the publishers and the people that make the article. So the other third question was about biases. We're always asked to look at the biases and how people are employed, where they're getting money from. So it said at the end of an article about the source of funding. So you can look at that. You know, that might be a way to contribute to the biases. And then also, you know, a lot of times you remember the things that you read the first and the last in articles a lot of times. So this one, they put their opinion right at the beginning. So that's what they're stating there. It's what they want you to convince you of. So, you know, how reliable factual do you think the article is? Are the conclusions of the article supported by the facts? So a lot of these questions too, it's not, you want to answer these with some type of backing up what you say. Is this reliable factual? You can say yes, but I'm really looking for why are you saying yes or why are you saying no? Okay, not, it shouldn't really be what the answer is per se, but you should have some reasoning for that. So that's the critical thinking. Apply your critical thinking stuff to this. And then what facts are they provided here? You know, particular information as opposed to you know, someone else disagrees with me. And what data do you have to back that up? Opinion of the article and the author. So again, when it, you know, we can ask for your opinions and stuff, but everybody has opinions. So how would we actually evaluate this? I mean, everybody's, if you just put an opinion, you know, there's no way you can actually get it wrong or be criticized for the answer. So when you give opinions, say why. You know, if someone's gonna ask you, is this airplane safe to fly? You know, they wanna know, yes, this is safe because it just was reviewed or it was just, it goes through the safety program. You know, the reasons behind it is really nice. So, because otherwise I don't wanna just hear an answer. You're not here to just make me happy and tell you an opinion. Which I really don't have an opinion on this article. Well, strong, you know, this is the right answer. I don't know, does that help any? So I think on Tuesday, if I get time, I'm gonna try to have a compare and contrast. Think about this article compared to the other one and how it's evaluated. Because one of the things we try to do is, you know, I can say a lot of facts, but you shouldn't believe them just because I said them. Of course, what I say is right. But you shouldn't believe them just because me or Fred Reamer or other people, you really should think about it. And also think of the biases in them. Because, so, you know, apply the critical thinking and so it's not, you know, this is applied weather modification. I'm not here to try to get you convinced of any one opinion, but to be able to talk and understand the science, the subject matter. Okay, so your grades are not, if you believe weather modification works and should be used, it's, do you understand the topics, the material in terms of the stuff we can measure, the stuff we can discuss, the theories that we have about them. And so, okay, so questions, comments, difficult assignment. So this is, it's hard to think and evaluate critically. And then even my graduate students sometimes say, we're analyzing the effectiveness of this weather modification project. And you know, we don't want to go into that like, oh, we want to prove that this works at this level or something. We want to look at the data, have the data come up with, and the analysis of that data lead to the results. But scientists a lot of times don't always do that. So okay. Don't worry too much about the assignments. I shouldn't say that. I always tell the students, don't worry too much about the grades, but everybody does. The key point is to really understand and get something out of it. And that's the same for the class. So anyway, I hope I posted that on there. I hope that helps a little bit about that. Oh, that's my study guide. So we'll talk about that at the end. But I wanted to also get through the rest of the rest of the lecture from nucleation. So we need to cover this lecture for a test. So we did nucleation and water vapor last time. So we're trying to put them together. And we got up to ice nuclei. So does anybody have questions on the stuff before this? Water vapor, nucleation. Okay. So the last topic, I guess I'll go back to, maybe I should do this in terms of tell you the questions that will be on the exam. It doesn't help the students, well, maybe it does, but the relative concentrations, there will be a question related to this somehow in terms of having this concept of a lot of particles, aerosols, condensation nuclei, there's a whole lot of them. And the concept that there's a few cloud condensation nuclei and even a fewer number of ice nuclei. So a lot of times when we talk about concentration, we talk in terms of number of the particles because that is what controls the number and the types of cloud properties. The mass doesn't really control it. But we'll have something about this relative concentration. So we talked about what's most abundant, which is all the particles. Then we talked about the cloud condensation ion nuclei, which form the water droplets, and then the ice nuclei. But the main question is, you know, I have something like, you know, which of these are the most, put these in order of abundance to, from most abundant to least abundant. But there's lots of different questions like that we can ask. So we want to talk about ice nuclei. And so typically we say the freezing process requires a starting point. You know, you need to start and form the ice particles from something. Okay, there's a start to this formation of the ice crystals. Once it starts, then it's a very rapid process. And a lot of times these are referred to as solid particles, ice nucleus. So nucleus is one, nuclei are many. So many particles are nuclei. You're talking about one as a nucleus. And then I share with you, you know, the videos that this really points that these fusion points start at. So, the other one is sources of these. They're a little bit different than the general sources. Types of preys and certain bacteria, a lot of times soil bacteria. So the soil and the dust gets up there. And I don't even think that the preys are necessarily settled yet. There may be bacteria on the preys that make a difference. So I've done some work. That's what I'm showing here is some pictures of bacteria particles, which are can be pretty big, but long strands of bacteria. But there's lots and lots of bacteria in the soil, so the wind and stuff grows these up. And we made measurements when I did the Florida project. We put a filter on the aircraft, flew up there, 35, 40,000 feet, sampled the air, and we found bacteria. A lot of them were soil bacteria. And you can, and nowadays I had a student, so my undergraduate student for a senior project, he did DNA sequencing on the soil bacteria. And it would cost us several hundred dollars to do a sequence of the bacteria on a sample that during a flight. And he said, oh, that's expensive. And I'm like, compared to what? You know, because 20 years ago, they paid millions of, well, billions of dollars to sequence the human DNA sequence. Now we're sequencing the bacteria for an undergraduate project. So we can sequence them, and then if you know the type of the bacteria, then we can go back and look and see where does that come from. There were also some bacteria from some farming activities, other stuff. So we could trace back where these are, where we find them on the surface. So that's some of the newest interest. And then I'm also doing some work where we can. So one way to make better ice nuclei is to manipulate them. So I'm working with a microbiologist. He could take genetically modified bacteria to have a lot of ice proteins on them, or proteins that form ice. So these are little shells to that. And he can put these on the inside or outside of bacteria. Then he can kill the bacteria, rip out the insides of the bacteria, and they rip with all these ice proteins. So, and they work great as effective ice nuclei at warm temperatures. So we can make these bacteria to make the ice proteins that we need to nucleate the particles. So we're trying to do that as a material to improve that, but we might have a lot of issues with the acceptance. So we don't use the term genetically modified and bacteria, because then we have to explain, well, what are they? And it's the process of getting these ice proteins. So we come up with a couple names that for the material that he makes. So the other thing is nucleation. So there's two types, homogeneous and heterogeneous. So homogeneous, it doesn't involve a particle. You always need a starting point, but you can form these out of just pure gas molecules if it gets cold enough. So somewhere like minus 36, minus 40, you'll form ice particles without any aerosols. So that means you can have supercooled droplets up to that point. And so we're looking at a paper, I was just working on publishing now, trying to convince people that we're seeing supercooled droplets at minus 33. Celsius. So that's very cold. And you would think there'll be enough ice to dry there, but did the clouds and everything retreat them enough? So heterogeneous nucleation is basically nucleation of water droplets or nucleation of the ice particles. It's a statistical process. And you know, how long does it take supercooled droplets to freeze after a long enough time? So you know, you can get it cold enough and you can wait long enough, it will freeze because it's a, it's not a thermodynamically equilibrium. But a lot of times we need to wait till we get these ice nuclei. So the thing that we want to talk about in terms of weather modification a lot of times is the effectiveness of the ice nuclei. And a lot of times it's measured in terms of a threshold temperature. So one definition of a threshold temperature is when one particle in 10,000 will produce an ice particle. So if you have these ice nuclei and you get one out of 10,000 to actually get it to freeze. So it's a statistical process. You know, even if you had the same size particle and the same composition, they would freeze at slightly different temperatures. So where do you get a lot of it? Where do you get them to start freezing? It's a threshold temperature. So a lot of times you could say they range from minus 5 to minus 40. And some of the really good bacteria might be a little bit warmer than that, minus 2, minus 3. But you got to get enough of them to freeze. We say minus 5 because that's where AGI and a lot of bacteria will really be effective. And then I have another plot here of temperature.
Messed up on my slide. See if I can fix this. Come on, let me fix my slide.
So you can see the scale.
It's not the one I wanted to fix.
See. And now you can see concentrations and per liter. So these are what we call factors of 10. 0.1, 10, 100. So this is a log scale on the y-axis. So it's the number of them per liter. And a liter is a big, not a cubic centimeter anymore. Okay, so it's 1,000 times bigger. So, you know, you kind of like a liter of pop or a 2 liter of pop soda beverages. And you have temperatures here from minus 10 to minus 35. And you have different types and different super saturations of material. The idea is that there's a huge range of concentrations of these particles. Okay, and I'm not going to ask you concentrations, but these are number per liter, where the other ones were number per cubic centimeter. The ice nuclei are a lot less. There's not many of them. So that's a very important concept. Okay, we can add in ice nuclei and affect the clouds because the atmosphere doesn't have very many of them. Okay, compared to what we can add tens of thousands per liter, get them into where you have these super cool droplets. So that's the concept. There's not many ice leaf droplets. That's what the atmosphere lacks. And that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. It's an empirical observation. You know, if we had a big source of some bacteria or stuff being emitted, we could have lots of them in the atmosphere. The other question that will probably be on the exam is something related to this slide. Is that how does the ice nuclei actually form the ice crystal? How does it nucleate them? And there's different activation types or methods. So one is, so we have the particle. So here on the representation to the right, we got ice nucleation mechanisms, types of activation. So here it represents what an ice nuclei, what a square. And then this mechanism process occurs, and then we say that it's activated. It activates to form the ice crystal. After the activation, the ice crystal is formed. Before the activation, you just have the ice nuclei and you have water vapor or liquid water. So the hexagons are the ice, the round particles are droplets. And then the square root of particles are the ice nuclei. Okay, so maybe have a little diagram on here. So you can go directly and have deposition of vapor directly onto the ice nuclei to form an ice crystal. Okay, so that's direct deposition with no water droplet. The one that might be the nicest and the way a lot of AGI works is condensational freezing. And that's contrasted with contract freezing. So when we do experiments in the crowd chamber, we try to determine is AGI a contact nucleation nuclei or a condensation. So one is when you have contact is the third one, the ice nuclei contacts the surface. The condensation is the droplet forms with, and within that droplet, there's an ice nuclei. And then at the appropriate temperature, you form the ice crystal. So one comes from the outside, one's in the middle. And then, I should contrast the fourth one. And the second one, when there's immersion and condensational freezing. One is condensational freezing is when you form the droplet initially, it's formed with the ice nuclei in it. The immersion is when you have the droplet and a particle enters that droplet and is immersed in it. Okay. They both have droplets and they both form the ice crystals from the inside. But one is the ice nuclei is actually in it when it's condensing from the vapor phase and forming a droplet. The other one, you form a droplet and then it enters. But it doesn't freeze it on contact. That would be the contact one. So it's kind of hard to think about these differently. But the idea is that there's different mechanisms that this works. And different ice nuclei will do that. The AGI is a good contact nucleation, but it also is a good condensational particle. It's a lot of bacteria and sort of stuff.
Does a lot of this depend on like what temperature you're actually seeing at? So like if you're flying around at like 10 degrees Celsius, then you drop your seed material in the cloud, and then you would be going through like an immersion per se, but then if you were at like a colder temperature, it might be a contact.
No, it usually works well. It can't be if you have condensational freezing, right, you have to have it form on a droplet. So if you're going to do this one, you have to release it before the droplets form. So you would release a base where it would go up. Okay. So and if you're doing something like this, and that's one reason why people would say, well, let's put the AGI in at cloud base so that you get it incorporated into the droplets. Okay. But there's the drawback then of where we're getting into the part of the cloud that you want. If you may be spreading this out where there's not updraft, it's going around the, and not getting into the cloud. Okay. So there would be a difference between these two on where you see it, the temperatures. But it's not really a temperature per se, it's just how the cloud forms, which we're talking about.
So then the immersion one, you're putting the ice nuclei into the droplet, and then it's freezing?
The immersion is, you get it into the droplet first, and then it takes some time. And then usually the temperature would change.
And is that because the droplet ends up higher?
Yeah,
the
droplet ends up higher, but sometimes they stick around. So when you do that, a lot of times if you're doing top seeding and you're seeding at like minus 10, you have both of these that could be happening. But it doesn't really depend, it doesn't switch. I mean, if it happens at minus 8, minus 10, minus 12, it's going to be the same process. But we could maybe see if which one's more effective. You know, you might have more of them happen in one way, but I don't think we've done enough work to really say, you know, between these two, if there's a difference, right? From what I understand, it's really not a temperature difference. So one or both of these can be happening at the same time. That's my understanding. So basically, if you're top seeding, I'm doing these two.
So is then what separates between the contact and the immersion seeding nuclei that you would use? Like, would you use a different, or would you use like sorbitol, or is it the same, or I don't know?
Just some of them would be more effective on, you know, some types of ice nuclei more effective as contact and immersion, but. A silver iodine is a good contact nuclei, but I think it can also be effective for the other ones, but it does contact and freeze it. So it's kind of hard if you're at the, particularly if you're at a cold temperature, right? You're not going to get it going into the droplet if you freeze and make it while it. So if you're top seeding, you really want a good contact nuclei because you want to right away freeze the droplet and create your ice. So if it's a good contact one, that's all you really need. At least if it's super cold and it's minus 12. The other question is the effectiveness of the temperature, right? So one of the things with the furs and materials, I guess it's, I'll just go on to this one, and sorry for my reader. Oh, I know why it is. I gotta do my screen, so the projector's different than my, when I do it on my computer because of the XY resolution. So I think that's it up. It looks fine on my computer. What I bring here, anyway. I have temperature, I have, well, that's not the one I want. This is another part.
but I'll go back to my temperature one.
And so these plots are from papers, and I didn't put in where I got them from, but you could find these in a lot of different papers. But if you see here, there's a lot of, if you go over here, cold temperatures, there's a lot of ice you can ride at that can activate in terms of high concentrations. So a lot of times you don't see the crawls until minus 10, minus 12, because you know there's a lot of particles that act. But it does work if you remember back to my video that I showed earlier with the crowd chamber. You can form the ice, we're at minus 6. So when I put the ice, the AGI into the crowd chamber, we did like minus 3.5 Celsius, we did minus 6 and minus 9 and minus 10. I can't remember the high one right now. But the idea was you get a lot of them at minus 10. Very quickly, a lot of particles form. Just about as many at minus 6. But when we put them in at minus 3, we get no ice particles forming. So it's not active, not effective. Sorry, it's not effective at minus 3. And I can show you that because we put it in the supercooled droplets, we measure the temperature, and you're not going to do anything at that temperature. But if it gets up incorporated into the clouds, and the cloud gets colder, then you might have to do it. But if the cloud is not colder than minus 4, there's no other place for it to go, so it's not going to work. But it's kind of nice that it does work at minus 10, because there's not many naturally occurring ice sheets, right? Until you get to like minus 20, is when you get a lot of, so I don't know, kind of put a flat line on that. You know, 10 per liter. At minus 20, there is typically a lot of ice we've got, but it depends on the conditions and the lot. But so that, because of that, a lot of times you measure at minus 20. To measure concentrations, because a lot of them are active by that temperature. But there's not very many of them because there's, you know, only like there's, you know, 5 orders of magnitude difference. So this is 10 to the third, this is 10 to the eighth. Okay, so that's like the difference between 1 and 10,000. That's a big difference. So that's the key concept to remember. And the last point is, someone asked a couple of lectures ago about related aerosol concentrations to ice nuclei, because ice nuclei are hard to measure, but aerosols are relatively easy. So a lot of times we don't measure the ice nuclei because we need very complicated, expensive, hard to cool instruments. And particularly if you measure naturally occurring ice nuclei. So we had ice nuclei counters in the citation before, but it's a difficult measurement to make. But what's a lot easier is just measure the aerosols larger than 0.5. And we can do a linear fit. And this is, of course, over orders of magnitude. So there is some relationship, but there is a huge scatter to it also by like orders of magnitude. So, you know, very low concentrations, very hard to measure, and a lot of scatter when we do measure it. Because there's not many of them. So the final slide is a repeat of the first one. And that is lots of aerosols, somewhat less cloud condensation nuclei, and then very few ice nuclei. So that's what the exam question will be on. Is I'm not going to ask you how we measure ice nuclei, or, but that's the key concept. Okay, questions?
Did you look through the homogeneous versus the heterogeneous distribution?
Yes, I kind of skipped over that kind of quickly, didn't I? So there's two types of nucleation. And typically, we talk about the heterogeneous nucleation. So heterogeneous requires an aerosol, a particle. Okay. So, but you have homogeneous nucleation. If you get to minus 40, you will form ice just by condensing out of the vapor phase. You don't need the particle. But minus 40 is pretty high in the atmosphere. You know, but this is where you could form rather cirrus clouds, very high, and white clouds up there 30,000 feet.
For homogeneous, you're just going from vapor to particle, and then heterogeneous, you have like a droplet to particle?
No, it's not a droplet. It involves a aerosol. So if you go back to the next slide, oops. I get the right one yet. This one. So this is all heterogeneous. Okay, because these are my little aerosols. So heterogeneous involves the little particle. It involves a solid particle or a droplet and or. The homogeneous is just when you have gas phase water and ice phase water. There's no particle and there's no droplet. So, but sublimation is on a little particle.
Okay.
So this is an aerosol particle. So the homogeneous would be from gases to ice. And I didn't put it on here because for storms and stuff, it doesn't really matter. Because the only place is very high up in the troposphere, and you can get fair weather, cirrus clouds, but you're not going to get any precipitation that falls over them. So homogeneous is there because for completeness, but if you're going to have storms on the earth, you're going to involve a heterogeneous process.
How does it affect the ice particles, the nucleus that can be captured? Is it either within it or just on the surface? The difference between contact
and the ice particles, they don't care. I mean, because I don't have it to size here, but these are very small compared to the ice. And very small is like 1,000 or 10,000. These are like 20 nanometers. I'm sorry for the units, 10 to the minus 9, 0.002 micrometers. But these are on order of at least 10 or 100 micrometers. So it's on the order of 10,000 to 100,000 times the diameter. So it's huge. Okay, so the mortar particles, although sometimes even I can, the crystals and stuff, you can see it really forms in the middle. The snow crystals can form outwards from it. But the very start of it is very small. That kind of answer your question. So it doesn't really, these are not to scale.
Yeah.
And droplets are not to scale either.
What is the difference between contact
and the contact is it freezes right on contact, right when it hits the surface. These ones freeze from the inside out. with a compact is it freezes on the surface. It doesn't get incorporated into the droplet. This is kind of difficult to understand the difference. And then this one is immersion, where it gets put into the droplet after the droplet has formed. Where this one is right in the center because it forms around the droplet. I mean, it's but a droplet forms around the ice cube. Understand? And things can happen, like there's questions like these immersion ones, do these move around? So does it freeze better when this immersion one contacts the surface? Or does it freeze from wearing inside of them? So, Nick.
So what contact condition, is that instant freeze or does it just hit the surface and then it just happens to stay there until it goes?
No, it's pretty much instantaneous. Okay. So it's instantaneous when it hits the surface, but it will freeze from this point up to the droplet. But it starts right when it hits it.
And then immersion is not instantaneous.
The immersion is not instantaneous, and that it goes inside the droplet.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the immersion. Okay. So these three, you know, these four different mechanisms can be complicated. And so that would be the hard question to really distinguish them. But we want to understand that there is some type of process that occurs, and that there's different ones, and we can study the different ones.
Do you see a lot of difference in these modes between like summer convective storms and winter snowstorms? Or does it not matter?
Well, I mean, the depositions usually have to be pretty cold to have. And I could fix this, so cut that off. But it's not really important in terms of what mechanisms freeze the ice. It's more important at what temperature occurs.
Okay.
Because it doesn't matter how you get it. Right? So if you're gonna make ice, it doesn't matter how you get to that ice for the storm. But what really matters is the temperature at which it occurs. And that's the part that you have with AGI and is why it's not the mechanism that causes the ice that's important. It's the fact that it happens at a warm temperature.
Mm-hmm. And we've just found that there are a couple different mechanisms that happen.
Yeah, there's a couple different mechanisms, there's a couple different ways that ice can form.
Okay.
You know, so there's different processes that we understand that could form the ice.
But what more to do with what?
Yeah, I mean, what you want to do, because I guess the thing I haven't really told you is if you form the ice, the whole reason we want to form the ice is that the ice, and we talked about this a little bit before, but the saturation to go from the vapor phase to the ice phase, if there's water and ice together, a lot of times it's easier to condense onto the ice after it forms. And you can take because the water droplets are constantly losing it, it's hard to get these mixed phase crowd conditions. Because if you get the ice, all the vapor and all the droplets want to go onto the ice. So once you get ice, then it's easy to get big particles that precipitate. Okay, and if you get big particles, they start to fall. So the whole idea for rain enhancement, at least, and snow enhancement, is to get big particles. And the way to get big particles one of the most effective ways to get big particles is produce ice. Because then it's very easy to take the water vapor onto the ice phase. So you got to remember what we were. If you want precipitation, and if you don't want precipitation, you want the crowds to be there for a long time, the opposite, get rid of all the particles. So I'll tell you, stay after crowds. I'll tell you a military secret I have. How the military doesn't form their contrails, right? They don't want to be visible by the aircraft. So if there's conditions that you have contrails and you'll see the airplanes, right? Well, they figured out how to get rid of that. So I'll tell you that after class if you stay. So anyway, we could take a small water break here. But and I keep hiding my hey, there's both my airplanes. Looks like they're still there. Oh, they had a little bit of icing back here. Doesn't look that interesting to me on these measurements. Let me load that. But they stack back and forth in mines, so back and forth through the snowstorm. But they've been doing it in other altitudes, so that's probably the. I should do it on the videos here, but you can see this is the research flight. They went up, and they were heavy, right? So they were down lower, then they got up out for the transit. And then they step down and they're going through the clouds at different altitude levels. So they go back and forth on these legs and they just step down through the clouds. Because we want to sample how the clouds are at different levels. And then there's a corresponding temperature on the red. So, okay. Great that you guys are asking questions. And we can go over more of this on Tuesday, but this is a little study guide I put together this morning. And so at least you can get started. I can't get it quite all in here. So what I have listed here are the major topics kind of in order. And then I have subtopics like North Dakota crowd modification project, location, flight hours, and partners. So when you study, you don't want to be there all day and all night and take a whole lot of time. Let's look at each one of these topics and make questions about them. Okay, so it should be obvious, right? If I have, we could turn this around into a question. What is the location of the North Dakota? What are the location or locations of the North Dakota weather modification project? How many flight hours did they do per year, per month, and has it been changing over 5 or 10 years? What are the partners involved in the North Dakota weather modification project? So your job when you study is make up the questions and then answer them. That's what I'm going to do for the test. Okay, so I just go through these questions and make, you know, these statements and make up the questions. So you do that, you answer the questions, and then that's your study. So I haven't done that extra step for you, but it's not hard. And you know, there's no secret about how we do this. And you have all the presentations and the stuff. So make up the questions and then honestly see if you can answer them. That means don't answer them with the PowerPoints right there, because on the test, you're not going to have the PowerPoints. So make up the questions and then go through each one of these. Does that make sense? Yes. You can look at the lectures and stuff, but you want to be efficient at study and just answer these questions. And it's fine. You can get together and, you know, have different people make them up. Get two or three people and ask the other person your question. You know, have everybody make up a question on each one of these and go around the group. What's your question? And have the other people answer it. Should be very efficient. And then you'll do well because you answer all the questions, and it really won't be about any other topics than these. And frankly, there's only about 4, 5, 6 questions I could possibly ask of each one of these. So you basically have the test in front of you. You just got to make it up. So, yeah, I'm getting dry here with my talking so long. I'll let you ask me any talk. So go ahead and do that. Make up a question, ask me, like I'm your study partner. What questions do you have about these topics from way back in the beginning? Someone make up a question for one of these. I did the first one. No one wants to try that?
What liabilities does the weather modification program have to deal with in North Dakota?
Insurance. Airplane needs to be insured. And the other liabilities is that because there's a government program, they're immune to a lot of the liabilities because the government can't be liable. But there's the normal business liabilities of any business. So, you know, you have to rent it. There's more risks. I think there's liabilities and risks. There's liabilities if you don't have the permits. The permits actually help protect, because if you got a permit, then it reduces the liability. So sometimes companies don't like having a requirement to get permits, but there's the other way around, that if you do have the permit, then it reduces some of your liabilities. So there's advantages too, as long as you can get the permit. So you have to have a permit in North Dakota to do. Other questions? Okay.
So stuff we were talking about today.
Yep.
So ICPI. Is that like the processes that we were talking about? Is that mainly talking about like precipitation generation and rainfall, or is that also talking about like lowering the size of the hail?
Yeah, so here are some questions a little bit more complicated. So we'll get to how these concepts relate to hail suppression. Basically, hail suppression is hail is formed with a lot of supercooled water. So if you eliminate the supercooled water, you eliminate the big formation of hail. So it does relate back to both, but we really haven't talked at all about how these concepts of converting liquid water to ice is beneficial for hail suppression, right? So we'll have to talk about that later in the class. So maybe we talked a little bit more about how it's beneficial for precipitation enhancement. because you get the big particles and then they just fall down. But having the ice nuclei is beneficial for the hail too. And of course, there's other things, you know, because there's other weather modification techniques. So one would be fog dispersion. So how does this relate to fog dispersion? Or even pollution dispersion. So there's other ways that you might be able to use weather modification, but we focus a lot on the North Dakota project. Put that in context of other ones. So we'll talk a lot about hail suppression, but only a little bit about fog. So I'll let you guys go, go through these, come up with your questions, and you can ask me other questions on Tuesday, and I ask you the questions on Thursday.
What's the limit to how much we're going to pump in before it starts getting us really good?
We do discuss that because it is a limit how much HCI you can put in the clouds. No, it's basically, well, think about one. Think about what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
You're trying to convert all the water droplets to ice. There's only so many water particles in the cloud. So after you, and if you only need one particle for every water droplet, and you convert that all to ice, there's nothing else you can do. Right, so, you know, there's only so much water there to begin with. This is why it won't help this release AGI out in the environment. There's no clouds, there's no water. And likewise, if there's already ice there, it's not gonna do any good.
But I guess the question is, how much do we need to convert significant amount of that water?
The aircraft, one aircraft can usually cover the area. Okay, it's not like you need to have two aircraft right there, but sometimes they have one down below, one up above. But the other thing is the duration, right? Because your aircraft can only fly for so long. So you could, you know, to be effective, you need enough aircraft so that when one goes down, you have a replacement right there, right? The other thing is, it depends on the area, right? So if you get one cell here and another one here, so if they're spread out, you need to have separate airplanes. So it depends how long they last and how big of an area. So if you're gonna do a bigger area, you need more aircraft. So if you reduce the number of counties, and then you reduce the area, then you don't need as many aircraft. If you have more area to cover, you have to have more aircraft. Right? So that kind of makes sense. So they can scale it. And of course, some of that too is the type of aircraft, right? If you have a more higher performance aircraft, it's going to go faster, give you better. Better coverage, right? It can cover a bigger area because it can move faster. But of course, it probably is more expensive. So there's a cost benefit trade off for that.
Yeah, I see the wrong document from my second owner. I sent you the correct one, but it's so,
yeah, I haven't looked at that. Did you send it to also to Google?
No, I did not.
Okay. Can you send it to her? She should have on the syllabus. She should have her.
Okay, I'll do that. Do you want me to copy you to that?
Yeah, you can just copy me on it.
Okay. I can do like late.
No, you can forward the email original one.
I'll forward it, okay.
Yeah, you just forward the original before the podcast.
Because I did it and I immediately did, so I sent you an email.
Yeah.
Fine.
Oh.
Yeah, before the original one.
Let me know the training.
Is there a way to like reset it?
I don't think so. That's the problem. I think on the system is, I can check that when I create the assignments. I have the option if you can resubmit or not. And I think I did it so that the default is that you can't resubmit it.
Okay.
But I could change that
from
the default. And it's like most of these things, we go with the default until we find a way to change it.
Yeah.
But I figured, let's see, I mean, if this one person that has problems all the semester, probably fine, you just email it.
Okay.
If it's if everybody starts to have problems, then I'll just create the next one already. Submit multiple times.
Okay.
But you can't submit multiple times the way I set it up. So
yeah, I'll just forward it.
Yeah, just forward me the email and forward it to her. And I would try to talk to her after class to get a couple of them fixed up.
Have to ask about the military.
Oh, you want me to tell you my classified military secret?
Yes.
Okay. Now I, you know, this is something I